Sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. On the 15th anniversary of 9/11, the Justice in Focus Symposium took place at Cooper Union in New York City. The focus of the conference was to look at what legal avenues could be pursued to get 9/11 truth in the courts, to present the mountains of evidence that prove that the official account of what happened on 9/11 is totally false and fraudulent. Today you'll hear attorney Daniel Sheehan of Karen Silkwood fame discussing this issue and what we're up against. What you'll hear today is the second part of Daniel Sheehan's speech, and it begins with him talking about the need for a network of grassroots organizers around the country to support any legal efforts concerning 9/11. The 9/11 Truth Movement has this network of groups all over the country. So we should be in a good position in terms of the support needed for any legal action. So let's begin. Here's Daniel Sheehan with the second part of his speech given in New York City in September of 2016.
The Karen Silkwood case we had during the Iran-Contra case that Sarah Nelson ran out of our office, our executive director, she ran the entire grassroots operation around the country. We had like 1,000 Christic action teams. Many of you may have been members of those. So that they were writing letters to the editor. They were, if Oliver North showed up somewhere to speak at the Kiwanis Club or something, they would all come and fill the room and jump up and down and ask him questions. You know, these are the kind of that you're going to have to be prepared to do. This is not a normal case, okay? Whatever the theory is that you come up with, which is an alternative theory, if you get a professional investigation from the Justice Department or an official investigation from the United States Congress or any other type of commission, that they are all political creatures. That's why they're there. They will undertake a political activity. I want to call to your attention something that Gary Sick wrote. Barbara Honecker wrote a book on this, but so did Gary Sick, who was the national security advisor for President Jimmy Carter. In Jimmy Carter's negotiations with the Iranian government, when our 52 American hostages were seized at the American embassy in Tehran, Jimmy Carter, you remember, was trying to negotiate to get our hostages back. And during that negotiation, Gary Sick, Lieutenant Colonel Gary Sick, Lieutenant Commander in the Navy, he actually was his assistant in the National Security Council. And it became perfectly evident that somebody inside the National Security Council was leaking the information about the state of these negotiations to Bill Casey, who was the campaign chairman for Reagan and Bush, competing against Jimmy Carter for the presidential nomination in 1980. And we developed all the evidence that showed that Bill Casey, and some evidence indicating that even George H.W. Bush may have gone with him on one of these occasions, had traveled to Paris, had traveled also to Madrid, and had met with representatives of the Hezbollah to negotiate with them to keep the American hostages, to keep them in custody until after the election in 1980, so that Reagan and Bush could win by showing that Jimmy Carter was weak and vacillating and couldn't really even get our own hostages back. And Gary Sick wrote a book about this, it was in the aftermath of all this, called The October Surprise, because a special prosecutor had been appointed to investigate all of these wild allegations that this had actually taken place. And the special prosecutor came in with a whitewash report, and Gary Sick wrote a really interesting piece in the conclusion of his book called October Surprise, in which he said, basically, that those of us who have lived in Washington, D.C. for 20 years or more have become accustomed to the various political scandals. An individual congressman is caught with his hand in the till of his campaign funds for using it for private purposes, or another senator is found to be a persistent womanizer and caught swimming nude in the pool on the Capitol lawn, and all of their colleagues rush in to excoriate them. And the news media flock in and reprimand them in a great celebration of showing how the system works and how they've called this person to account. He said, but these are petty offenses. And there's another whole category of political offense, described by the French poet André Chenier as le crime puissant qui font trembler les lois. Their offense is so grave that they cause the very foundation of the law itself to tremble. And he said, we know what to do with someone caught misappropriating funds, but when confronted with evidence of a systematic attempt to undermine the very democratic political system itself, we all recoil in a general failure of nerve. And he goes on to point out that that's what happened with regard to the October surprise. And he makes direct reference to the Iran-Contra case and how they completely backed off. All of the major political officials backed off from really pursuing what was going on in the Iran-Contra case. And in fact, we finally got a special prosecutor appointed, Lawrence Walsh. I was handpicked, but only because Ed Meese ran out into the national media on October 25th of 1986 and said, oh, what do you know? Oh, gee, we found this young lieutenant colonel all by himself, ran off and ended up selling TOW missiles to the Hezbollah and taking part of the money and putting it into a bank account in the Caribbean to go to the Contras, in apparent violation of the Boland Amendment. But fortunately, he's been fired now. But just to be sure, I'm going to write up a charter as the attorney general asking for a special prosecutor to be appointed to determine narrowly whether President Reagan ever, in writing, specifically authorized the sale of TOW missiles to the Hezbollah and the transfer of a portion of the profits to the Contras in violation of the Boland Amendment. And he figured that he would stave off the entire rest of the investigation by so narrowly defining what the scope of the investigation was. And the special panel for appointing special prosecutors of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, all the justices of which had been appointed by Ronald Reagan or George Bush Sr., that they'd all been appointed by them, they end up selecting as the special prosecutor the senior partner of Crowe Dunleavy, the law firm that we beat in the Karen Silkwood case. They choose the senior partner of the very law firm that we knocked over for $10.5 million judgment, the largest civil judgment in the history of the United States up to that point in time, and brought him in as a special prosecutor. Now, I was glad because he's one of the few people on the planet that knew that we were completely right, you see, because he already had experienced that the hard way. So he did know that when we say something, you better bring it to the bank and bring your checkbook with you. So we were the very first people that they interviewed, and we began to give them all of this information. And lo and behold, we managed to convert the special prosecutor to actually doing a real job, at which point the entire constabulary in Washington, D.C. turned on him and began attacking him and charging him with flying on first class when he went back to Oklahoma on weekends during his tour as the special prosecutor, et cetera. So that you have to understand that the Republican and Democratic Party are joined at the hip, not just when you come to the shore in all foreign policy, which is what we're dealing with in this particular case. To give you another dramatic example, when we were closing in on them and getting all of this information revealed, John Kerry, who I had actually proposed to Claiborne Pell, the ranking Democrat on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, to be the chairman of a new select committee to investigate all the charges that we made, that I went to see Tip O'Neill, Russ Hemingway, the director of the Fund for an Effective Congress, and a close friend of John Kennedy's, recommended I go see Tip O'Neill. He called Tip for me. I went in and saw Tip O'Neill, the Speaker of the House, told him the whole story. He sent me over to the Senate side to meet with Claiborne Pell. And Tip O'Neill said to me, he said, look, when you ask him to set up this special select committee, if the Democrats win the Senate back in the fall of 1986, he said, this was in June, the first week of June of 1986. He said, in the fall of November of 86, we're going to have the election. And if the Democrats, we can win back the Senate, then you go over and talk to Claiborne Pell and get him to agree in advance that they'll set up a special select committee to investigate all of these charges. He's going to ask you who you think ought to head up that committee. You tell him John Kerry. He loves John Kerry. We kid him that John Kerry must be his illegitimate son. He said he loves him so much. Claiborne Pell thinks John Kerry is going to be president of the United States. And I said to him, I said, that's funny. So does John Kerry. So I did. I went over and I recommended it to Claiborne Pell. He, in fact, as soon as the Democrats won, they set up the special select committee. We start hand delivering all this information to John Kerry. end user certificates, you know, tail numbers on the airplane, secret code words, witnesses, the pilots that we got to tell all about it. And they're overwhelmed by all of this stuff. And they actually put together a preliminary draft of a report from the Senate Select Committee on Terrorism and Narcotics telling everything that we're saying in the Iran-Contra case is true. We get a copy of the draft of it. So we know what they were getting ready to say. And then all of a sudden, I get a call from Russ Hemingway. And Russ says, Dan, I got to talk to you right away. He said, look, I got to tell you. I just came, just this minute, came out of a meeting. I was meeting with John Kerry. He said, and we were having a private meeting, and in walks the Democratic senator from Michigan, Don Riegel, comes in, and he says, John, I got to talk to you privately right away. And John Kerry, rather casually, says, no, that's okay. You know, Russ is fine. He can stay for the meeting. And Riegel says to him, look, I've just come from the leadership of the Democratic Party, and they have said that they've been approached by the leadership of the Republican Party. And they're saying that, look, if you all by yourself make a decision to drop this investigation, the whole Iran-Contra enterprise and the smuggling of the cocaine and the assassination operations they're engaged in and that whole off-the-shelf enterprise that you're looking into, and it's totally up to you. The Democratic leadership wants to make it clear it's totally up to you. But if you do decide to drop this, the Democratic Party leadership wants me to tell you that they will be very, very, very grateful to you personally in the very near future. So I said to Russ Hemingway, I said, what the hell does that mean? He says, that means the vice presidential nomination when Al Gore runs for the presidency in 2000, is what he said to me. Now, this is like in 1992. Right when Gore and Clinton are getting ready to run. So, I mean, that's how far in advance these people on the inside know how things are being arranged, okay? The only reason that John Kerry wasn't given the nomination in the year 2000 with Al Gore is because Al Gore was so royally pissed off at Clinton for having lied to him about the Lewinsky affair that he actually selected, instead of John Kerry, who he was directed by the Democratic Party leadership to make his vice president, he selected Joe Lieberman. Because Lieberman was the only guy on the United States Senate who stood up on the floor and chastised Clinton for lying personally to his own best friends about this. And that's exactly why Al Gore picked him to be his vice president. And you remember that Al Gore did not allow Hillary Clinton or Bill Clinton to make one single solitary appearance on behalf of his campaign during the entire campaign in the year 2000. Okay? And so I've lived this for 50 years. We've been in Washington, D.C. for 20 years. We've been on the inside of these things for a long time. I'm telling you, this is one major hill that you're talking about climbing. But we have climbed a few in the past, all of us together. And the fact of the matter is that this may well be the biggest hill ever to climb because of the type of theories that are being implied by some of this evidence that is being developed are so extraordinary that they qualify as one of these types of crimes that shake the very foundations of the legal order itself. And that's exactly what you're dealing with here. So I just wanted to give a few principles and lessons to the women and men who are going to be the legal team that are planning to evaluate this, investigate this, and to all of you out there, not only the people who fill the audience here, but the people all around the country and around the world that are listening on the internet. You know, that you, if you're going to support this operation, this undertaking, you need to be prepared for this type of a confrontation. And you need to not wilt in the face of this. And so you need to be extremely careful about who you select as your plaintiffs. Listen to me what I'm saying. You need to be very careful about who you're selecting as your plaintiffs. There's a complex operation going on here on the part of the American institutions attempting to buy off the families of the 9/11 victims, setting up an entire fund to pay them off, to get them to waive any claims that they have against anyone. There's a whole effort underway to deal with just laying it off onto this group of Saudis, possibly even some individual financiers of the Saudis, if they can't avoid that. But they don't want to hear what this group is planning to talk about. They don't want to talk about the implications of this. They're perfectly willing to be considered to be fools, in complete incompetence, you know, in lying bold-faced about not having had any advance warning of this, but they don't want to talk about the fact that the Able Danger, a military exercise, was going on at the same time, Vigilant Guardian. They don't want to talk about the fact that somebody could have taken an opportunity to launch this attack right at that exact same time. They don't want to talk about any of that stuff because all of the implications of that require very high level, very sophisticated coordination. And they do not want that talked about. Okay? So you got to understand, if you select an individual plaintiff, forces that we're dealing with potentially here will go to almost any lengths to buy them off, to offer them everything that they've ever wanted and more, to buy them off individually. So you need to be very careful. You have to have people who are dedicated down to the very soles of their feet to get at the truth of what's happened here. And that they're not in this just to be remunerated. They're not in it for any personal advantage. So you have to be extraordinarily careful. In closing, you have to be extremely careful about who you name as defendants. Because you need to remember that the naming high enough level officials are going to cause them to invoke national security claims. They're going to refuse to produce the discovery. The judges are going to go along with their national security claims. You have to be extremely careful. So you need to have, as consultants to your legal team, people who are experts at the particular trial court that you select, the Court of Appeals that has jurisdiction over that and who the personnel are on that particular Court of Appeals, and have experience in litigating appeals in front of that court. And you need to always keep in mind that this case that you're talking about is going to end up in front of the United States Supreme Court. You need to understand that. So you need to keep your eye on who those personnel are. You know, and no matter how much the media wants to keep on claiming that there's this conservative side and liberal side of the court, we know that that's not true. All there is a completely reactionary part of the court and a conservative part of the court, okay? And it's not likely that Hillary Clinton is going to be appointing any major liberals, certainly no progressives. So that you're going to have to craft this very carefully. And the mix is going to be a little bit different because Justice Kennedy may no longer be the swing vote to craft your case to pitch it to Kennedy and looking at his past decisions, et cetera. So you're going to have to do this very carefully. This is going to be extremely high-level litigation. And you can bet that you're not going to have any big law firms lining up to help you. Okay? You're not going to get the Cahill Gordon litigation firm coming on board. You're not going to get any of the big law firms coming to help you. They will all cite conflicts that they have. Oh, we represented somebody from one of the potential defendants back 100 years ago. So the bottom line is this is going to be a major challenge. You have to gird yourself for this. You need to stay in direct communications with people who have knowledge about these types of cases, at least on a consulting basis. And what I'm saying is that the key is having the kind of support from the people that's absolutely indispensable in a case like this. So you have to develop the grassroots organizing. You have to develop your media campaigns. And ultimately, you're going to have to, prior to the filing of your complaint, you're going to have to determine what the exact theory of your case is. You can't really go into a case like this saying, well, maybe they were dupes, maybe they were incompetent, maybe this, maybe that. You may be able to do that if a Boeing 757 were to land only on top of your private house. You, as a plaintiff's lawyer, you can sue the airplane company, you can sue the people that are manufacturers, you can sue the Pilots Association, you can sue, you know, the weatherman. You can sue anybody you want, and then you can sort of peel them away as the discovery unveils information. That isn't going to happen in this case. You know, you're going to get one shot at this. You're going to get one shot at laying in what the theory of the case is and who it is that did what to whom and who was involved in the support network. And you're going to have to put that in front of them because the judges are going to apply, just like the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals did, a heightened level of scrutiny over the factual information that you bring in at the initial front end of this litigation. Okay? And they're going to try to dismiss it under Rule 12b-6. They're going to say, even if you could prove what you say, there's a legal problem that you can't really get at this. Or they're going to say that it's ineffective in convincing us, the judge, that is, convincing us that you can, in fact, get the kind of court admissible evidence that you're going to need to prove every essential element of the claim, even if we give you access to civil discovery. You're going to have that to confront. You're going to have to gather this information. You're going to have to put it all together. You're going to have to cross every T. You're going to have to dot every I. You're going to have a huge mass support around the country. And you're working at that. That process is underway now. As the panel has said, there have been advances that have been made even just recently as yesterday, that show that there's an advance being made in the progress on this. But the last item I'll leave you with is do not drink your own Kool-Aid. Okay? Do not drink your own Kool-Aid. You know, don't come up with some great theory that necessarily that Dick Cheney sat in the bunker and coordinated all this from a single-eye computer, and just because that happens to fit your own ideological predisposition. The bottom line is you're going to have to work at this thing from the bottom up, gather your information, discern the patterns, identify your defendants, identify your causes of action, then go after this in a big way. And once you start, you better not stop. You better not stop. You better not delay. You're going to have to go all the way on this thing. So that's just my advice from 50 years in front of the courts in this country. So that's my advice. I'm giving it to you for free.
And again, you were just listening to attorney Daniel Sheehan of Karen Silkwood and Iran-Contra fame, speaking at the 15th anniversary 9/11 Truth Conference in New York City called Justice in Focus, where he spoke about what it entails to bring a politically charged case like the truth about 9/11 to the courts. As many of you already know, all of the 9/11 cases brought by victims' family members were steered to one judge in New York City, and that's Judge Hellerstein, where all the cases were blocked so that none were even heard in a court of law. Since the official story of 9/11 isn't based on any solid evidence, they can't allow any of the real evidence, which disproves the lies they've been telling us for 15 years, into the court system, where it could be heard and become part of the record. April Gallup, who worked at the Pentagon on 9/11 and survived, did make it to an appeals court in New Haven, Connecticut, where then-President Bush's cousin, once removed, was one of the three judges. April Gallup and her lawyer, Bill Veal, were both fined, and I believe it was $15,000 each, for filing a, quote, frivolous lawsuit. So every effort is being made to discourage any kind of 9/11 evidence getting into the courts. The Moussaoui trial is an example of why the powers that be must prevent this at all costs. In the Moussaoui trial, it was revealed by the FBI that the alleged phone call from Solicitor General Ted Olson's wife, Barbara Olson, who was allegedly on Flight 77, which allegedly hit the Pentagon, well, it was revealed by the FBI that this alleged phone call lasted 0 seconds. Now, this alleged phone call was the one where Barbara Olson supposedly told her husband that the planes were hijacked by Middle Eastern men with box cutters. That's how we learned about these supposed Middle Eastern men with box cutters on the planes. Now, not one mainstream media outlet covered this new information, this really shocking new information that really challenges what we've been told about 9/11, but not a word. The consequences of 9/11 are catastrophic, and 9/11 is being used as the justification for the attacking, destroying, and occupying of many countries in the Middle East and beyond, causing millions of deaths and destroyed lives. There's rock-solid evidence that the United States created al-Qaeda and now has created and is supporting ISIS, along with its allies in the Middle East, all in the bogus name of fighting the war on terror, which they also created. So it's really important that we educate ourselves about what's really happening and then do something about it. First, I want to recommend the website globalresearch.ca to keep up with what's really going on. And then I want to ask you to all contact your senators and congresspeople and tell them that you know. Tell them that we know. That we know we've been lied to about 9/11, and that we know that the U.S., along with its allies, have created, funded, and aided ISIS and its affiliates in the Middle East. Tell them we know, and we want it stopped. And we want a real and independent investigation into 9/11. And if you don't do this, then who will? And now I'm going to end the show with that famous speech by Wesley Clark, where he talks about all of this being planned right after 9/11. And here he is, General Wesley Clark.
About 10 days after 9/11, I went through the Pentagon and I saw Secretary Rumsfeld and Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz. I went downstairs just to say hello to some of the people on the Joint Staff who had used to work for me. And one of the generals called me and he said, "Sir, you got to come in. You got to come in and talk to me a second." I said, "Well, you're too busy." He said, "No." He says, "We've made the decision. We're going to war with Iraq." This was on or about the 20th of September. I said, "We're going to war with Iraq? Why?" He said, "I don't know." He said, "I guess they don't know what else to do." So I said, "Well, did they find some information connecting Saddam to Al-Qaeda?" He said, no. He says, "There's nothing new that way. They've just made the decision to go to war with Iraq." He said, "I guess it's like we don't know what to do about terrorists, but we've got a good military and we can take down governments." And he said, "I guess if the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem has to look like a nail." So I came back to see him a few weeks later, and by that time we were bombing in Afghanistan. I said, "Are we still going to war with Iraq?" And he said, "Oh, it's worse than that." He said, he reached over on his desk, he picked up a piece of paper, and he said, I just got this down from upstairs," meaning the Secretary of Defense's office, "today." And he said, "This is a memo that describes how we're going to take out 7 countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq and then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off Iran." The truth is about the Middle East is, had there been no oil there, it would be like Africa. Nobody is threatening to intervene in Africa. The problem is the opposite. We keep asking for people to intervene and stop it. And there's no question that the presence of petroleum throughout the region has sparked great power involvement. Whether that was the specific motivation for the coup or not, I can't tell you, but there was definitely, there's always been this attitude that somehow we could intervene and use force in the region.
And that does it for the show today. And just a reminder that 9/11 Wake-Up Call shows are archived at radioforall.net. And that's the digit 4, so radioforall.net. Once on the site, click on Contributors, and then on Cheryl under the letter C, and the show should pop up in chronological order. 9/11 Wake-Up Call airs at WWUH on Wednesdays at noon and 8 p.m., and on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. at WESU FM. You can also catch the shows by going to noliesradio.org, and they are also intermittently aired at the radio station at Boston College, sometime on Sundays between 6 and 10 a.m. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake-Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.